This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
the Tanzania Communication Regulatory Authority said the owners of online platforms must pay about $900 to get a license.
That's Muhammad Yusuf reporting from VOA's East Africa Bureau in Nairobi. Details next.
Also, researchers indicate 69% of sub-Saharan African immigrants in the U.S. have some college education, 6 percentage points higher than the level for native-born Americans. And the U.N. is calling for an investigation into the killings of civilians in Yemen by Saudi-led coalition airstrikes.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, bloggers and others running online platforms in Tanzania have 2 weeks to register with the government or face fines and jail time. Rights groups are expressing concern about the measure, which stems from a new law regulating online content. Mohammed Yusuf reports from VOA's East Africa Bureau in Nairobi.
The new law in Tanzania targets online platforms like blogs, podcasts and other streaming live content. For example, via YouTube channels. The government says it will monitor the platforms for hate speech, obscene content, and threats to national security and public order. Local bloggers fear the oversight will be used to stifle dissent. Maxine Mello is the founder of Jamii Forums, a website about corruption in Tanzania. He has been detained several times since 2015. Including 2 formal arrests.
We have been through a lot of pushes from our government in a couple of past years because authorities wanted to know our whistleblowers, and we said we cannot do this. And most of these whistleblowers are the people who were helping to reveal some misconduct in the government. And as we speak, we are still facing 3 trials, and all of them are about revealing the sources of our stories.
Tanzania's government spokesman declined viewers' request for an interview. On Friday, the Tanzania Communication Regulatory Authority said the owners of online platforms must pay about $900 to get a license. The state agency also said it will use suspensions to force the removal of content it deems in violation of the law. Those who fail to comply the new regulations could face fines and up to a year in jail. Reporters Without Borders has slammed the license fee as exorbitant and called the new law the latest blow to free speech in Tanzania. Since taking office in 2015, President John Magufuli has cracked down on a range of issues, including corruption, tardiness among civil servants, and criticism of his government. Newspapers seen as critical have been shut down or their licenses suspended. In February, 2 opposition politicians were jailed for allegedly insulting the president. Henry Maina is the East Africa Regional Director for Article 19, a global NGO that promotes freedom of expression and information worldwide.
Tanzanians are beginning to organize themselves online. And so here is a clear measure of a state policy to try and close down civic space. And in so doing, they are not only closing down the physical space, they are also closing down the virtual space so that Tanzanians cannot organize.
Maina points to a regional trend. Countries like Uganda, Democratic Republic of Congo and Ethiopia have cut the internet or restricted access to certain social media sites during times of unrest. Rights groups like Article 19 urge restraint.
There is a big discussion globally on how to perhaps regulate social media, but that must not be equated to criminalizing social media. That yes, regulation may be required, and if so, the regulation must be done for only 3 or 4 main purposes. One is for purposes of protecting the reputation of others. 2 is for purposes of what will be narrowly described as national security. 3, public morality. And 4, public health. Any other reason that states may throw up as a reason for regulating or control of social media in and of itself would be a violation of human rights.
In Tanzania, bloggers and administrators of other online platforms have until May 5th to get registered. Their licenses then will come up for renewal for a fee every 3 years. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
In Malawi, the debate is heating up on whether the country should resume executing those convicted of murder to stop repeated killings of people with albinism. At least 20 people have been killed since 2013 under false beliefs that their body parts have health benefits. Many people say the spate of murders of albinos is because of lenient sentences given to the perpetrators. But rights activists say the death penalty is inhumane. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Malawi President Peter Mutharika called for a national dialogue on death penalty following repeated attacks on people with albinism. Malawi's law does allow death penalty, but no president has signed a death warrant since the introduction of democracy in 1994. Instead, murder convicts have been given life sentences. Imran Sharif of the Chancellor College of the University of Malawi says failure to sign a death warrant is wrong.
The problem they do is that when they refused to sign execution warrants, they don't pardon the person. It leaves the person out to serve for life, which means the person still lives with psychological torture in his mind. What if the incoming president would be willing to sign?
He says it would be better for a convict to know that he will be killed than to live at mercy of other person. Sharif also says the death penalty is the only way to deter potential murderers. Social commentator Ahmed Chienda agrees.
You know how we should implement it? The perpetrators should be taken to an open ground and they should be executed there while the public is watching. Yes, it will be dehumanizing at that moment, but they will also stop thinking of killing each other like the way people are doing at the moment.
However, the United Nations says Malawi should take a sober approach towards ending attacks on people with albinism. Maria Jose Torres is the UN Development Programme representative in Malawi.
First, because it undermines human dignity. Second, because it is irreversible, meaning that innocent person can be executed, and if it is proof he or she was innocent, it is going to be repairable. And third, there is no conclusive evidence that the death penalty is a deterrent for future perpetrators.
She says the death penalty should not be implemented. Torres says Malawi should instead strengthen its justice system to ensure that killers are given tough sentences. The death penalty isn't necessarily popular nationwide. A study by the Paralegal Advisory Service Institute, or PASS, and the Cornell Law School in the United States found that 94% of traditional leaders in Malawi are against the capital punishment. Clifford Nsisi is the National Director for PASS.
They have cited several reasons why they think that the penalty is not serving any good. For instance, they said innocent people might be killed, would not give people chance to reform. The people that we have killed cannot contribute to the society, and the trauma that is associated with the death penalty.
Heather Wekintaba heads the government's technical committee tasked with ending attacks on people with albinism. Ntaba says the government is still mulling over the right approach to take to end the attacks as it debates the death penalty. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
A new report shows that African immigrants in the United States are college educated and employed about the same rate as the general population and more likely to be educated and working than those in Europe. The Pew Research Center today says 69% of sub-Saharan African immigrants in the U.S. have some college education. That's 6 percentage points higher than the level for native-born Americans. In Britain, about half of sub-Saharan African immigrants have some college education. In France, the number is 30%. The Pew study finds that about 93% of African immigrants in the U.S. have jobs. In Europe, employment figures range from 80% in Italy to 92% in the U.K. One explanation for the difference in education is that Europe is easier to reach for low-income Africans. But higher education and employment levels may not translate into a higher income for African immigrants. Earlier Pew research shows black immigrants from Africa have a median household income that's about $8,000 lower than the U.S. average.
In the Gambia, the government of President Adama Barrow is working with the World Food Programme, WFP, European Union and the United Nations to end hunger in the country. This follows a WFP report saying the Gambia faces a food crisis. Panderambai reports for VOA.
The World Food Programme estimates 268,000 Gambians have found themselves in food crisis. It also says 48% of the population lives below the national poverty line, while 8% are food insecure. The WFP attributed the food shortage partly to decreased crop production and rising inflation. It says basic commodity prices have skyrocketed in the Gambia. The government, in collaboration with the WFP, European Union, and the United Nations, is tackling the crisis. Daryl Sexton is the project manager for the EU delegation in the Gambia.
This response is part of a global package that the EU has put together in the Food Security Nutrition Complex. We've got five contracts in total, many of which are involving UN agencies, but we also have one with quite a big NGO working here, United Purpose. And what we're hoping to do as we move forward is streamline the steering committee coordination processes of all of the projects and bring them under one roof.
Out of the seven administrative regions in the Gambia, four of them, all rural areas, have been declared poverty-stricken. Mutar Jame is a program analyst at the National Authorizing Officer Support Unit, NASU.
The goal actually, which is already highlighted for the project, is what we want to see achieved, which is mainly to improve on household food security, particularly targeting the most vulnerable households, and to improve on nutritional outcomes, you know, targeting women and children.
Part of the WFP's programs in the Gambia includes fighting malnutrition. Children below the age of 5 are screened to provide them nutritional support during the hunger season before harvests are done. Sarah Nyanti is the UNICEF country representative in the Gambia.
We are working to scale up some existing programs in these areas and working with governments through NANA and our Ministry of Health to ensure that we reach the targeted beneficiaries.
Gambian farmers have been hard hit by the food shortage. Agriculture accounts for the greatest chunk of Gambia's gross domestic product. Low rainfall coupled with poor harvest have hurt Gambia's farmers. The Food and Agriculture Organization is working to provide seed and other supplies to vulnerable farmers to help them recover. Dauda Cisse is a permanent secretary at the Ministry of Health and Social Welfare. Is confident that the effort will work.
We believe that through implementation of this project by our partners, i.e. UNICEF, the World Food Programme and the FAO, we believe that in concert with the relevant sectors such as the Minister of Agriculture, the Minister of Health, the Minister of Basic Education and our private sector operators, we believe that this will go in a long way in making major, major changes in the lives of the ordinary communities, especially women and children.
The European Union has allocated millions of dollars to the WFP to help eradicate hunger in the Gambia. The EU intervention also includes providing free school meals to affected regions in the Gambia. For VOA Africa, this is Panderimbai reporting.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. Well, sudden Sudan filed a complaint with the United Nations Security Council after Egypt held presidential voting in the Halyeb Triangle, a mineral-rich border region that both Khartoum and Cairo claim. Sudan says its sovereignty on the Halyeb Triangle is not negotiable. Peter Pham is the vice president for research at the Atlantic Council and director of its Africa Center. He tells VOA's Mohammed Al-Shanawi that the real tension between the two countries is over the future water rights from the Nile River after a new Ethiopian dam begins affecting water flows to Egypt and Sudan.
This is a dispute that has lingered for more than 6 decades. It predates the independence of both Egypt and Sudan, dating back to some administrative decisions made by the British colonial rulers back in the very beginning of the 20th century. So it's not been resolved for many years. However, I think one has to understand the current tensions as growing not so much from what occurred or didn't occur in the Halyeb Triangle in the last month, but really rather the ongoing tensions in the region because of the controversy over the Nile waters.
The Sudanese foreign minister said, "We have two alternatives to solve the issue, either by negotiations or through international arbitration." But he said that Sudan's position of full sovereignty over Halyeb Triangle is not negotiable. Would that lead to a confrontation between the two countries?
There's nothing new in Foreign Minister Gondour's remarks that has not been said before by his predecessors and other Sudanese leaders. And the same might be said on the Egyptian side, going back to President Nasser. So there's nothing new in the claims of both sides to the Halyeb Triangle. And one can go into all the ins and outs of it. But I firmly believe that although there is an issue of the voting in the recently Egyptian elections and the Sudanese sensitivities about that, I think a far bigger issue is what is motivating the tensions between these countries, which have a long linked history. And if one is honest, one has to say it is the imminent prospect of the completion of the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam and its implications for the flow of the Nile. Not that the dam is going to stop the flow, but the usage of the water that does flow will flow regularly once the dam is fully operational.
But negotiations over the Ethiopian dam failed so far to produce any compromise. Is there still room for some diplomacy to ease these tensions?
I think there's room for both diplomacy and science. And by that, what I mean by that is Egypt and Sudan, but not Ethiopia, are parties to the Nile Waters Agreement. What has happened over the decades has actually been because the water comes in one large flood every year and then followed by a dry spell. The flood in the Sudan means Sudan is not able to use all the water that is allocated to it, whereas Egypt actually uses more than the water allocated to it because what the Sudanese don't use, the Egyptians pick up on. With the creation of the Ethiopian dam, what's going to happen is the water will flow regularly throughout the year, which means Sudan has a greater opportunity to use what was allocated to it by this treaty. But if they do use their full right, Egypt will be left with less water, not less than what it was entitled to, but less than what it has been used to using. Now, how do we solve this problem? I think that's where science, diplomacy can make way for science, and science, we have make great advances in hydrology over the years, and that has to be an opportunity to defuse the tension. But that will take patience, and it will take effort and goodwill on both sides.
That was Peter Pham, director of the Atlantic Council's Africa Center. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shanawi about the rising tension between Egypt and Sudan.
And in news from Egypt, Egypt's former anti-corruption chief faces 5 years in prison after a military court convicted him of spreading news that harms the armed forces. Hashim Ganina was arrested in February after he said that former presidential candidate General Sami Anan had documents regarding Egypt's political events that would be released if anything happened to him. Ganina was part of Anan's short-lived campaign for the presidency earlier this year. Annan was arrested in January, shortly after he declared he would run in the March elections against President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. Annan was accused of forgery and inciting the military. El-Sisi, who came to office in 2013 after leading a coup to oust elected civilian President Mohamed Morsi, won re-election last month. He had only one rival in the race, a man whose party had previously endorsed Morsi's re-election. Ghanina ran Egypt's anti-corruption office until el-Sisi fired him in 2016.
The UN Human Rights Office is calling for an investigation into the killings of dozens of civilians in Yemen during the past 4 days by Saudi-led coalition airstrikes. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the Rights Office in Geneva.
The UN Human Rights Office reports Saudi-led airstrikes killed at least 45 people, all civilians, and wounded many more, including women and children, in 3 separate incidents. The first attack on Friday reportedly killed 21 civilians, including 5 children, traveling in a vehicle in a village in Taiz Governorate. 2 days later, human rights monitors report many people were killed and injured in 2 separate incidents. Human rights spokeswoman Liz Throssell says the most devastating of these occurred at a wedding ceremony. She says 2 coalition airstrikes destroyed a wedding tent, killing at least 19 civilians and injuring some 50 others. She says the final toll of deaths and injuries may be higher.
Local inhabitants informed our staff that the victims do not have any political affiliations, not to say that that would have made the wedding party a legitimate target. They also said there were no military objectives in the vicinity of the targeted area at the time of the attack.
Throssell tells VOA she does not know whether the attacks on civilian targets resulted from mistakes or were part of deliberate actions.
We have, over the years, since March 2015, documented numerous attacks, often when large number of civilians have been killed, in cases like wedding parties or funerals where civilians gather. But it's clear that such incidents continue to shock, and that is why it is so important that there is an independent, thorough investigation.
The UN Human Rights Office is urging the Saudi coalition to fully investigate all these latest deadly attacks. It adds those found to be responsible should be held accountable and reparations should be provided to the victims. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Linus Remkes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, join us for a special broadcast on autism, hosted by VOA health correspondent Lenore Madu. She will host a panel of experts to demystify the developmental disorder.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.